From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois' state government and politics.
I know there's been a lot of people anxiously awaiting action on the remaining components of our grand bargain proposal. Unfortunately, I've been informed that the governor has decided to interject himself in this process and doesn't want this approved in this form.
I would ask you to confirm with my Republican colleagues, but we've been told he's called them into his office one by one and threatened them if they vote on this grand bargain.
The governor's not a type of guy who threatens. He will be happy to share his opinion, but I think that's a complete mischaracterization.
You can't negotiate like this. I'd love you to go and ask the Republicans, if we were going and talking to the House, how would they like that? That was never the deal. We were working here, Senate Republicans, Senate Dems, on an agreement. And it's time to actually stand up and actually put some votes on this.
It's not evidence that anybody's walking away or that the governor's been heavy-handed with us. We know what we need to get for the districts that we represent, and that's we're working with our leader and with Cullerton and the Democrats to resolve those differences. That's what the give and take of this process is all about.
The end of the day is not you get everything you wanted. The end of the day is you compromise and you get some of what you wanted. A two-year property tax freeze is a significant accomplishment, but the governor doesn't know how to declare victory.
Well, can we finally stop calling it a grand bargain? Because it doesn't seem like it is there yet. What happened with this attempt to get a budget through the state Senate? Did the governor sabotage this effort? We'll talk about that and more today. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also in our State House Bureau, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. And he's joined by John O'Connor of the Associated Press. John, good to have you on again.
Thanks, Sean.
So let me start by saying we thought there would be a vote on this big package of bills, and then things seemed to hit a wall. Brian and John, why don't you fill us in on what took place?
Well, like you said, definitely hit a wall. The grand bargain wound up in the bargain basement or the bargain bin. Choose your stupid joke about it. But what happened was there was negotiations have been going on since December. Senate Republican leader Christine Rodonia went to the Democratic Senate President John Cullerton and said, can we work out a deal? Let's cut Governor Bruce Rauner out of this. Let's cut House Speaker Michael Madigan out of this. Negotiations go on for a couple of months, and fast forward to this week. There was a series of votes on some of the easier things to get done, some of the less controversial elements on Tuesday that passed. There were bipartisan support for most of those measures. They came back Wednesday. We were going to have a vote midday. Well, we need to negotiate some more. We're going to have a vote mid-afternoon. They went to caucus, came back to the floor, and that's the audio we heard at the top of the show. The Senate Democrats say that the governor inserted himself into the process, and they say that he pulled votes off this deal, that it wasn't a good enough deal, and that they are blaming him for standing in the way of this attempt to finally end Illinois' budget impasse, which has entered its 21st month.
And John, let me ask you, have we heard from the governor about this, or has anybody confirmed that that's what took place?
Well, it's been, I don't know if you can call anything around the State House strange anymore, but it's been one of those situations. You know, it's almost this whole last 8-9 weeks is it's almost as if they've built a Potemkin village. A line editor said to me this week, you know, when the thing fell apart and I turned in my story. Editor said, I thought this was a compromise. And, you know, it was the first time it dawned on me that everybody has called it this compromise between Senate President John Cullerton, the Chicago Democrat, and the minority leader Christine Rodonia from Lamont. And yeah, they had characterized it a compromise all this time, but it's still, you know, one of the major pieces of legislation is a school funding of revamp that we still haven't seen language on. The other strange part of it is that, you know, all along they as Brian said, the intent was to cut out the governor, cut out the House. Let's try to get something done on our own and set, you know, mark a line in the sand or a starting point. And the governor played along and said, I'm not involved. I'm not involved. I'm not involved. And then at the 11th hour, he gets involved and says no. So people are wondering, well, you know, you could have saved a bunch of time by saying something earlier, or if you're really on the sidelines, then let it play out and see what happens.
I would add to that the governor, you know, has had this long turnaround agenda, right? This thing he introduced very early in his administration, about 2 years ago now, and that was kind of his line in the sand, right? There were some specifics. He wanted a permanent property tax freeze as part of that. Nothing happens. Finally, the Senate Democrats come around and say, okay, we can agree to a temporary property tax freeze. This seemed to be one of the big sticking points, at least that people were talking about this week, is this idea of how long should the property tax freeze be. The Democrats, you know, did not want any sort of property tax freeze. That's an important source of funding for schools and local governments in Illinois. But they agreed, okay, we'll have a 2-year freeze. And then there was another variation that we'll have a 2-year freeze where, and then a 3-year add-on if they go to the voters and the voters can choose to do that. And then there was going to be one where it would be a 2-year freeze with a 3-year opt-out. They were trying. And the governor's position has been a permanent property tax freeze. So it strikes me that, you know, you have on one side this attempt to bend toward the middle. On the other side, the governor is sticking with this permanent property tax freeze, which the Democrats say is a non-starter. And, you know, Senate Republican leader Christine Redonio appeared to be flexible and willing to bend on that. The governor doesn't, and I just don't know where that leaves us.
And we'll come back to all of this. Charlie, I did want to bring you in on this because you wrote about the idea of a permanent property tax freeze for Illinois issues. Your thoughts on that, and why is it so hard to get this done?
Well, I think one of the difficulties with a permanent property tax freeze is that you're telling local governments, and probably the most universally affected would be school districts, universally impact people because everybody lives in a public school district. There would be the same kind of consequences for smaller special units, library districts, park districts. Units of government that rely on property taxes for almost their sole source of support. Cities have sales taxes, they have amusement park taxes, they have a whole range of ways to get around it. They get a cut of the state income tax receipts, for example. They get money from the gas tax. So they're not impacted as direly. School districts rely on property taxes because Illinois doesn't fund its schools, the state, anywhere near the national level. And so if you're a local school district and you're looking at, I don't get much money from the state, doesn't look like I'm going to get much more in the future. Even what they said they give me, they're not paying me because the cash isn't in the bank. And now suddenly they're telling me that my one reliable source of income, the property tax, is going to be frozen at this year's level forever. Meanwhile, the costs of utilities, the cost of supplies, teachers' salaries, fuel for the buses, that stuff's not going to be frozen. That's going to increase. And the response that comes from the people advocating for this is, well, you can cut costs. For example, if you didn't have to collective bargain with those teachers, those pesky teachers' unions, if you could just pay them less, don't give them health care. And if you could not have to pay standard prevailing wages on any of your projects, you'd be able to save money that way. So you don't really need to increase property taxes from year to year. So I think that's the bottom line. The anti-union, anti-teacher sentiment in some circles, including, I believe, in the governor's mind, sees this as a way to break unions if you can just squeeze the funds that are available to pay teachers, because that's where the bulk of a school district's expenses lie, in teacher salaries. And I think the governor, I don't think he really cares, to be honest. I think he's so focused on getting what he sees as necessary to make Illinois a business-friendly, anti-union state that he's willing to pay whatever price, because he personally doesn't feel it.
So the governor comes out with this idea of a permanent property tax freeze, and, you know, I know there are people who are saying, well, he sabotaged this compromise that they were working toward in the Senate. But if this is what he wants, if he was going to reject this idea eventually, if it got to his desk, you know, why not weigh in now? It seems to me that makes sense.
Well, I think one of the answers as to why you would weigh in now comes from one of the rating agency groups, right? This is the, I believe it was S&P Global Finance, I think they're called now, and their bottom line is a deal is better than nothing, right? Some sort of deal is better than nothing. And right now, we're just where we've been for 21 months. There's no deal. And I think that if this thing had passed the Senate, that would be something that people could really latch on to. Yes, would it be the most perfect deal? Of course not. Would there be flaws? Would both sides be unhappy with aspects of it? Of course. But it would be something. It would be more than we've had so far. And I think that that would put pressure on the governor, and it would put pressure on members in the House to take up this. And, you know, if they weren't going to take up that particular deal, then they should propose their own. Remember, another curious aspect of this, and just getting back to the governor, and regarding what Charlie said, I think the governor would say, you know, and what he has said is that Illinois can't afford to spend money to improve schools the way it should and do things like that because we're paying too much to state workers and pensions and things like that, just to make clear what his view of this is. But what is curious about this is that the governor counted on this grand bargain as part of his allegedly balanced budget proposal, which really has anywhere between a $4.5 and $7.2 billion deficit in it. $4.5 billion. There's a literal line item on his budget proposal that was working together on grand bargain, which a couple weeks after introducing a budget that counted on that $4.5 billion, he seems to be personally responsible for telling people not to vote on that grand bargain, thereby undermining his own budget proposal this year.
John, is this thing dead at this point? I mean, or can they resurrect where they're at and try to appease the governor and get something moving?
Anything can always be resurrected here. And I'm sure that's what Senate Democrats believe. Although the curious thing is, during the last few weeks in February, early February, they started this. John Cullerton finally said, we're going to vote. And they did it again this week. I think John Cullerton knew that it wasn't ready, that he wouldn't get the votes, but he's frustrated. And he was trying to at least take the temperature of not only Republican support for these things, but his own caucus on some of these key issues. And I think he, you know, it was kind of throw up his hands and let's just do this. Now, of course, since it's been derailed, he's not going to quit. They've got something there to start with. But again, he also said on Wednesday, the next move is the governor's. Look, if you don't like this package, governor, time for you to step forward and say what you want. Now, the one thing that he has been clear about, as we've discussed here, is he wants a permanent property tax freeze. I'm not sure that that any of the proposals that are out there right now include what was originally part of the turnaround agenda, not only the permanent property tax freeze, but with it, flexibility for local municipalities to limit how they deal with unions and collective bargaining and prevailing wage and some of these giving municipalities more power over union contracts, which was has been opposed vehemently by Democrats. 2 years ago, in June of 2015, the House had begun passing property tax freezes without that language about flexibility for local governments. And I asked the governor, why not take that property tax freeze and declare victory? He said it would be a hollow victory. It would be a false victory. It's not a victory, an incomplete victory. But now he doesn't seem to be mentioning any of those things. He's just talking about the property tax freeze.
Well, he is in this so deep compared to, you know, maybe other governors who they'll push something and then they'll kind of give up on it after a couple of months. It seems to me that the governor feels as though, you know, this is his line in the sand. He's got to get something. Now, maybe there's another line that he's going to draw later. But at this point, it seems pretty clear that this is what he wants and this is what he has to have to get him to sign off on something and maybe to get other Republicans to do so as well.
Well, it occurs to me that sometimes you may have your line in the sand, but you have to look at the reality of the situation. And apparently Governor Rauner's unable to do that. He has this line in the sand. He knows that it's probably impossible to get the votes for it. And so anything lesser, he won't settle for. But the art of compromise is me not getting everything I want, you not getting everything you want, but both of us getting something that we can say we're moving the ball forward. And apparently the governor's not interested in doing that. you look at the language, and what it says, it takes the existing tax cap law, and it says instead of limiting your levy increase from year to year to the rate of inflation, it's going to be 0% from now going forward. When the tax cap idea was first introduced some 20 years ago, Governor Edgar campaigned as a candidate on that issue. He comes into office in 91, and he proposes a universal tax cap law covering all units of local government, covering the entire state. Well, he couldn't get that, so he settled instead in the negotiations with the Democrats, who at the time controlled the General Assembly. He settled for tax caps in the collar counties, excluding home rule units. A couple years later, they were imposed in Cook County. Then the option was afforded to downstate counties. Roughly a third of the 96 downstate counties have adopted tax caps, including Sangamon County. Another half a dozen or so flat out rejected them in voter referenda. And the issue hasn't been raised probably for 10, 12 years. There've been no referenda asking people, do you want to have tax caps? So the governor comes in with his property tax freeze, and given the dynamics, given the players who are involved, it's just unreasonable. It would be like had Pat Quinn said, for example, I'm not going to pass a budget or sign a budget unless you guarantee, what would be an example he really cared about, unless you outlaw handguns, something
ban
like that.
Ban all assault weapons or something, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just unreasonable. It's not going to happen, and it's part of negotiating is you have to realize where the limits are for the person with whom you're negotiating, and you have to adjust your demands to reflect that reality.
It does seem as though that some Republicans in the Senate have understood that. I mean, at least they are willing to try to compromise. Oh, they want the same
I believe, credit in the world to Senator Redonio. She is a courageous leader. She and Senator Cullerton decided we have to move the state forward. And so they hammered out the framework of a package that would allow Illinois to move forward. She came under heavy criticism from some of the governor's paid shills and some of the phony think tanks that he set up, attacking her and attacking the grand bargain, how Redonio is a sellout and blah, 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 all this nonsense. So it was probably difficult for her, and it was probably very unsettling to have her governor undermine her the way he did by calling in Republican senators and explaining to them why this probably isn't a good deal. Now, he maybe didn't flat out threaten them, but you can bet in the back of their minds is the millions and millions of dollars sitting there in his campaign coffers that he could use against them should they not follow his orders.
Brian, I know you wanted to get back in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, Senator Redonio, even to the last, was apparently willing to stick with the deal when Senate President Cullerton got up to say that there weren't going to be votes. He said, you know, this all along, this was going to be a bipartisan deal. There are some Republican ideas. Some of the bills were actually supposed to be sponsored and led by Republicans. And he said, I was told that Senator Redonio would be the only Republican vote for these things. So even to the last, she was apparently sticking with this. And it is very interesting. And I'm not quite sure what it says about the future of government here in Illinois that she would seem to have been so undermined by her own members and the governor. I think one thing that's interesting to think about here is that there has long been a division in the Illinois Republican Party between the more moderate suburban wing and a more fiscally conservative, socially conservative, traditionally, I guess, downstate wing, although I think you would put former Governor Edgar in that more moderate wing as well, even though he's from downstate.
Well, and
but
George Ryan
those
also.
Differences are deep. And you saw, right, George Ryan, those differences are deep. You saw them flare up a lot of times in the past 10 years in primaries when they brought Alan Keyes in to oppose then State Senator Barack Obama, who was running for the U.S. Senate. And I think that Governor Rauner managed to paper over those differences with, frankly, with money. With he came in, he had he was a good candidate as well. He convinced Republicans in the primary that he was the man for the job. He won the primary. He has been very generous with people who are willing to stick with him in campaign finance terms. And I think he sort of papered over those differences. And now I think we're seeing inside the Senate Republican caucus here some people who are saying, this is a terrible deal for taxpayers. We have to stand firm. We have to stand on our principles. And if that means shutting things down, then so be it. And you have other ones who are saying, this is crazy. You know, we've had hundreds of people laid off from state universities. Social service agencies are shuttering. People are literally dying in some cases. We've had stories of there was a woman who lost an couldn't keep the oxygen tank for her son because of the state health insurance has not been paid out in a couple of years. And they said, we need a deal. But this division is coming back up. The governor has been able to keep a lid on it so far. Apparently he succeeded in doing that again this week.
Well, John and Brian, let me ask you this question. Now we've talked about the governor. We've talked about the Senate. The House is back in session starting next week. Does the House suddenly have some upper hand again? Does Michael Madigan have some upper hand as the House Speaker and the Democrat there? What happens next as far as the House is concerned?
There's a House? it's strange how little attention has been paid to the House of Representatives in the past 2 months. And, you know, heretofore, it's been Madigan v. Rauner. You know, Mike Madigan is the Democratic House Speaker from Chicago, and the thing that the Senate deal did, or the Senate actions did, was take the focus off the House. I think the Senate kind of felt like, okay, we're kind of on the outside here, because the governor, when he talks about his troubles with the legislature, it's completely symbolized by Mike Madigan. It's always Mike Madigan's Democrats, even though some of those Democrats are in the Senate. So the Senate was trying to use its, you know, the lower profile that it's had in the past year or so to push forward some kind of deal. Now, it took the pressure off the House, if there was any pressure on the House at all. But that's been the other thing that has not been discussed is, should this get past? Should some sort of grand bargain get past the Senate? Will the House even consider it? I think, you know, the mention was made that there would be some pressure on the House, and I think that's true. But that's a whole nother dynamic.
And I would just add to that, John, that it is worth noting that House Speaker Michael Madigan did appear to be working through back channels to undermine this Senate deal on the Democratic side, just the way apparently the governor was doing. We heard labor leaders went into Senate Democratic caucuses and told them, you know, please don't vote for this. You know, the governor gets a win if we do this. And the Senate Democrats resisted those attempts to influence them. And they were ready to vote on things that they don't like changing the workers' compensation laws in the state and freezing property taxes. I think we just saw the Republicans went a different way. They had somebody trying to influence them, and they decided to stick with Governor Rauner.
You know, to be honest, it strikes me as maybe a better strategy for the governor, who's attempted to portray Mike Madigan as the cause of everything bad that's happened in the world for the last 30 years. Maybe he should have let this grand bargain go forward and put Madigan on the spot. Instead, now there are a lot of people, including myself, who blame the governor for derailing this. When had it passed and the House resisted it, we'd all be blaming Mike Madigan. So in a sense, Rauner did Madigan a favor.
Oh, Charlie, let me jump back in then. If it's the theory by some people that the governor doesn't really want to have a deal, do you feel that Madigan does with Rauner?
I think Madigan is in a difficult position because his members, I'm sure, are telling him, look, we have to do something. Our people back home are suffering. And Madigan historically has responded to the concerns of his members. Years ago, there was a talk about how Southern Illinois wasn't going to have any doctors because of medical malpractice. And so legislation to put a cap on non-economic damages passed the House, despite the fact that the Trial Lawyers Association was vehemently opposed. And Madigan's response was, well, the medical society did a good job ginning up local folks to be worried about their health care. Our members were worried that their constituents were worried, and so we pushed this plan through. Now, the Supreme Court threw it out as being unconstitutional, but nonetheless, that was an example where Madigan responded to the concerns of his members. And I think that concern is there today, and I'm sure that he's hearing from people that we have to fund state services. And so at the moment, he's kind of off the hook because there's nothing before the House, because this attempted compromise in the Senate has been tubed by the governor.
Time now for our notes from the field, and let me start with Brian Mackey.
Yeah, even though this grand bargain appears to be on hold, if not dead, one of the elements that had been discussed as part of it, it was in, it was out, I think in the end it was out, but is potentially removing the exemption on food, drugs, and medical appliances for the state sales tax. So right now there's a much lower tax rate you pay when you buy groceries or prescription drug, or not prescription, but anything, you know, headache medicine or something like that. This would have ended that. There was some concern that this would disproportionately hurt poor people and elderly, but it turns out there are some good research out there that, in fact, it is not a regressive tax, because most poor people don't pay taxes on groceries anyways if they're on the SNAP program, used to be known as food stamps. So ultimately, it might actually benefit the poor if you lower the overall tax rate, which was what the Senate compromise was considering doing, but continue to tax groceries and food and medicine.
John O'Connor.
There was an amendment filed on Thursday by Toy Hutchinson, who's a senator, a Democrat from Olympia Fields, and it spells out the things that the Senate thinks could be taxed in terms of services that are subject to the sales tax. And they are the things you might expect, like lawn care, tattooing, body piercing, private detectives and alarm services, some that you'd expect, some that you wouldn't think of right off. My brother asked me in an email how much sales tax would have been coughed up by the pensioners in our neighborhood from our mowing of their lawns over the years. And I figured out that Dick Searing, who used to pay me $2 every time I mowed, during a typical summer would have to cough up 87.5 cents in sales tax.
And I'm sure it was worth it, too. So we'll move on to Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the flash index has been reported by the University of Illinois, Professor Fred Geertz, and it shows that our economy in Illinois continues to grow because the readings are above 100, which is the point between growth and contraction. But in February, it was slower than in the two previous months. And one of the reasons that the professor notes is there's still downside risk relating to unresolved budget issues in Springfield.
All right, members of our broadcast today included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and John O'Connor. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us at NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.